Hey, good morning, and thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent. This is such an interesting project that you're working on, and I just want to start at the very, very beginning. Give us a general overview of Cascadia Stack. A general overview of Cascadia Stack. What do you do, and where does this name come from?
Thanks for having us, Lisa. This is so cool. Cascadia Stack, we just want to make emergency preparedness and climate resilience more acceptable, more accessible, and just more talked about, maybe even a hobby. We want to reduce barriers. And we address climate preparedness with skill building, but really we open conversations about climate anxiety. It's a real thing.
It is, and I want to take a moment because this is live radio, and I want you to switch your microphones because there's something exciting happening with your microphone, Drew, and I don't even know what it is, but you can just go like this.
Got it. Is that better?
That is perfect. And yes, you're listening to KBOO, Community Radio. And there's so much that comes in and out of these air rooms. Where does the name come from?
Well, Cascadia, it's the Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake. And that's a whole geology lesson. Maybe Amanda can talk about that. But stack, the stack is stacking your resources. And that's not only things, but it's our skills that we learn. And it's that mental understanding and that preparedness. And we need to stack that up and build a foundation so we're ready.
I do kind of want to hear from Amanda. Can you pass her that microphone?
Sure.
Because, yeah, this is a real live radio show. Got it?
I think I do.
All right, go ahead.
Sure. So I think when we talk about this, we're looking not only at the earthquake, you know, at Cascadia, but anything that we do to prepare, not just the stuff. You know, one of my mentors says, your stuff isn't going to save you. It's your brain. And so no matter how we prepare, you know, it's not just what we're gathering together, but it's what we're doing together and what we're thinking about and the plans that we make and bringing us together as a community and as neighbors to do this work.
You know, I just got back from spending a few weeks with my mom, who's 93. And what do we do when I'm with my mom? We watch MSNBC back to back all the entire time. And
yep.
I can sense that my mom is incredible. She's active. She's there. She's engaging politically, right? But I can sense that she too has, I don't want to say a negative attitude. I don't even want to say a fatalism, but I think she's disappointed that we got this far in our society and we're still worried about basic things, basic infrastructure. And that's what I love about this. So I want you to grab that microphone, Drew, because I want to ask you, the people that you're, who are you serving with the programs and what are we facing? I know that might sound obscure, but I want to know for real.
Yeah. So the people that we want to work with is everyone really, but we want to focus on the people that are facing barriers, either through language accessibility or maybe not really feeling like they fit in. To talk about climate, you know, stress and anxiety, climate work, volunteerism, activism, some people may not see themselves in that movement. Or preparedness, you know, people are busy, people have lives and jobs and caregiving responsibilities, and they may just excuse themselves to not make it a priority. And so we really want to support and educate people and really just to understand the depth and weight of the climate crisis, basically.
What I find with people is that we feel like there's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for myself, and I'm keeping it real right now, I feel like part of me feels like it's too late to change that or too late to do anything about it. But I've had a guest, a wonderful guest named Jordan Fink, who is with Build Soil. He's been on this show a couple times, and he says, no, actually, it doesn't end. We're all here. Whatever we have is what we build. And that's why we need to think constructively and think about what happens the next day or after the earthquake or after the wildfire. You know, there is always a next day. And how, and he also talks about the importance of building community together, weaving ourselves together is the thing that actually, it's what we should have already been doing. And we have to a degree, but that is the one thing that is the most important thing that we can do if we're afraid of the future, kind of, and a lot of people are. So Drew, can you talk about what is climate resilience? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, first, that is a really excellent point. I really appreciate that. And I want to also congratulate Amanda for sticking it out with me. She's been a fantastic supporter from early on, and a great volunteer and a strong advisor in this whole thing. And climate resilience, just it's something that we build. It's preparing to thrive. You know, with the climate crisis, it's not always what's happening now. I mean, summers and wildfires and extreme weathers, that's now. But really, we want to think long term so that, you know, when there are food shortages and different things that may come up, you know, if you really dig into the weeds, you really start to appreciate and understand what really could happen in the next, you know, 5-10 years. And we saw some of that in the pandemic with the toilet paper shortages. I mean, that was crazy, but that's an example, you know, the empty store shelves. And we see that with produce a lot, you know.
The kale really does go, whatever. I'm quiet, you're going.
Right. And so it's understanding it. So it's gardening, you know, how can we grow our own foods? And there's tons of Portland community gardens. I love them and I appreciate them.
Right. How did you come up with this idea? I know you're a brainiac. I know you've been studying. You're a scholar. You're an academic. Like, how did you come up with this idea? And did someone inspire you to do it?
Okay, plain and simply, the Trump administration. When that happened, I was like, oh, man, you know, what's going on with the world? And I was like your mom, you know, addicted to MSNBC. Rachel Maddow, she's my friend. We play Yahtzee. And no, just kidding. But that's what happened. I started to see the realness of the world and see the threats. And, you know, I got into some YouTube. And at the same time, meaning that I started to really understand preparedness. And there's a lot of people who are on the extreme, and I don't want to be that way at all. But I also started to take a geology class and started to really learn about climate change. I mean, I thought I knew. And I thought I knew about earthquakes. I lived in Southern California. But taking that geology class, I really got into it. And that's when I started to prepare and started, you know, putting away water and can openers and cans. Don't forget the can opener. That's important.
Kind of need that. It's interesting that you just mentioned Rachel Maddow, because I'm going to put this out. I'm not a registered Democrat. And when I watch MSNBC with my mom, sometimes it's hard for me not to snipe about, you know, that's just so DNC, you know. We're so divided by the politics. But I do have to also say, I really enjoyed the 2-hour special that Rachel Maddow did a couple weeks ago with what's his name. And she talked about her new book, and it's basically about the coming authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And at the end, All In with Chris Hayes. It's Chris Hayes is who she was doing it with. And it's basically a town hall format of a show, a question and answer show in front of a live audience, but it was pre-recorded. And I mean, she talks a lot about what would happen if Donald Trump gets reelected. And I know a lot of people are talking about this, and he's even using the word dictator. You know, he's saying things, and we probably should believe what he says when he says what he says. But someone from the audience asked her, well, what should we be doing to prepare? And I thought her answer was really thoughtful. And she said, for one thing, be organizing in your community. Be organizing in your community, be active. She also mentioned voting, right? But the thing that I really loved what she said was, take the time to make make relationships with people who maybe don't agree with you. Take the time to build common cause and community among people that are like not voting on your voting card. And I love that because I think that part of what makes it so difficult to deal with some, like as we're talking about this coming authoritarianism, and we could talk about that a little bit, because it is something that's hitting us. It's almost like a climate change of the politics itself. But it is our community that's gonna keep us going. And I just had to flag that. She's got a new book out. But I mean, I do want to ask you this. There's a lot of people who are listening now who dream of doing a community project. These are dark times, but everywhere I look, there's people doing wonderful things. And I know there's other people who are thinking about doing it. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, we don't have to rabbit hole on it, but we could if we want to later. How did you even begin to build community around this idea? Where did you start?
When I moved up to Portland, I decided I wanted to focus my volunteer time, because I'd been doing another topic before in Southern California, decided I wanted to get into climate change activism and advocacy. I wanted to get back to that. So I looked up my Portland chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby, and that's how I get started. I started tabling, and I highly recommend that. Find a group or a topic that you are passionate about, get involved, and do on-the-ground tabling at events. You're basically exhibiting your cause, and you're talking to people, and you're finding out different perspectives. People may not always agree with you that stop at your table, but it's a chance to listen. And then it just opens up doors. You hand out your card, you know, you exchange emails, you know, exchange the Instagram, and you start following people and reading and learning. And then you just learn about what's going on in that particular area that you're interested in.
Pretty much the most unglamorous thing that a volunteer coordinator ever asked you to do. Can you table? Here's some stickers. I got a thing. But it's face to face. It's, and that in so many ways, it seems like a really hard thing to do. I mean, what kind of response have you gotten when you were face to face with people? Did people look at you and say, no, that's just, it's too much, I can't deal with it? Or did people say, I want to get in your vehicle? What was the response?
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that you mentioned that, because there are people that say, I can, I won't, I don't have time, or it's not that important, or what about the homeless, you know, a dozen things. And you pick your battles. You know, behind that person, there's probably one or two people that would like to spend a couple minutes talking to you. So you just, you know, you let them go, but you're planting a seed. You know they've come across you, and they may see you on their feed, Instagram, whatever. And that's it. The more people you talk to, the more chances you have to get your message out.
I want to leap sideways for a second right here and say, my name is Lisa Loving. I'm looking for people who are working to organize unhoused people to vote, because in Oregon, you actually can do that. Mm-hmm. If you know of anybody out there, if you're listening right now, please contact me. I'm on social media. Let me know if you know an institution, an individual, a person who's doing that, because I would love to have that person on this show. If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving, our guest live in the George Page Master Blaster Memorial Air Room. Our founder and director, Drew Alcoser, and volunteer advisor Amanda Westervelt from Cascadia Stack, a local organization working to build climate resilience in surprising and impactful ways. I'm going to go back to you, Drew. Talk a little bit more about your background and how this is a social entrepreneurship for you. What is that, and why did you go that way?
Well, I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur since I was 18 and facing either college or the army. But long before the global climate strike of 2021, I was really just a spark. And like I mentioned earlier, it was Trump and my geology class. And then I got into volunteering with Citizens Climate Lobby and really learned about mitigation. And I started, you know, over the years, getting a little burnt out. In the meantime, I was finishing up my undergrad and doing a lot of climate research, mitigation, learning about the food systems and things. And that burnout was happening. And I was getting frustrated. And then we were in the pandemic, and I just felt so helpless. And what I decided was that I needed to be more empowered. And I started looking at, wow, this is really happening. And so I started looking at adaptation. How do we adapt to what's coming, to what's already happening? What are people doing? And so I kind of switched gears about that and learning about self-sufficiency and watching how the food supply chain issues were happening and how can we build up strength from that. And, you know, I mentioned growing my own food and learned about permaculture and all these different exciting things. And I finished up my undergrad and decided, hey, PSU, Portland State University, has a fantastic program for social innovation and social entrepreneurship. So I did that, and now I have a master's certificate.
What does it mean, social entrepreneur? I mean, so you don't, so is it like a, again, for people that are listening, because I know that there are people that tune into this show and they have a dream of something that they want to do. And I want people to just know what's working and what's out there. So does it, is it like the way your nonprofit is it the way your organization is structured? Or like, what is it that makes it that instead of a 501c3? Or is it a 501c3?
Well, technically is. We are a fiscally sponsored project of Cascadia Now, based in Seattle, a bioregional movement. But before that, I was going down the social venture sort of a for-profit way because I figured, well, if I want to, you know, create a job for myself, then I need to make money. But I didn't really understand until I started getting into some classes that nonprofits are money-making ventures too. They pay their employees, you know. They just turn their profits right back into the organization. So nobody's getting rich. The board of directors that kind of run the show and guide it, they're volunteers. So, yeah, social entrepreneurship and innovation is just ideas and sometimes products or sometimes their processes that enable social good and hopefully work towards social change. Because it's one thing to have a band-aid. You know, we can feed the homeless, but can we get to the root of the problem? Why are so many people, you know, going to those depths of despair? And it doesn't have to be if we can have the political will to change things.
There's definitely people who are just more entrepreneurial minded and other people that are more nonprofit minded, I've found. Mm-hmm. And I just, if you are listening, I don't think I'm allowed to give a call to action, but I sure hope you find your path because we need every mind and we need all the hands. Just saying. Shifting gears a little bit. One of the things that, Drew, that you had talked about a little bit before we did this show was that your graduate work at Portland State University that culminated in a research project that mapped the system of emergency management in the Portland metro area. And I don't know if this is going to be a moment when we need to, you know, pass the microphone. KBOO, Community Radio, passing the microphone to the people since 1968. But I don't know if we need to pass the microphone. But I want to dig into what is this concept of emergency management resources, because a lot of times we are thinking about the earthquake, but it can be a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So tell, what is in this this map? Describe it, mapping the system of emergency management in the Portland metro. What's on there?
Well, this is my capstone project for the Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship Program. So my colleague and I at PSU, I believe she's listening now, her and I wanted to look at the misconceptions that we had in the emergency management, you know, ecosystem that maybe Amanda can talk on too. But we really had this misconception about how things are not getting to people, that English is not their first language. And that may have been based on our own trauma or, you know, our biases of racism or, you know, maybe some transphobia, you know, whatever it may be. We were looking at our own experiences and putting that out into the Portland Metro Emergency Management System. And we did all this research and we did this map and we looked at, you know, PBEM, which is Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. There's RDPO, which is a bunch of acronyms anyway. But we looked at all the different positions and how they all connect. And it's just a web. It is so much. And we found these branches and departments and agencies, and we found that they're really short-staffed. And we also found that, you know, there is a lot of languages represented in the emergency management material. But the problem is that when a language is your second language and you don't grow up in that culture, You may not be able to explain the nuances. You may not be able to have that cultural knowledge to effectively communicate information. And it kind of makes it a little, you know, exclusive for people who are, you know, not native Portlanders, and they may not see and understand. So I think what we found is that it wasn't racism at all. Portland's pretty cool. Portland's awesome, actually. But we do see that there is a need for more vocational work and support for people in different cultures. So we have people sitting at the desks at Portland Bureau of Emergency Management, et cetera, people that are have the lived experience in those cultures that can convey the information. And so we can reduce those language shortfalls.
Can we pass the microphone to Amanda? Because I wanted to ask you about the work that you do with emergency management. Before we even started this interview, we were all in the lobby. I was pointing out where the bathroom was, and Amanda said, "Oh, I have my whole emergency management kit with me." You know, and I had to make her leave it because she was just going to take it everywhere. I mean, if it's okay, can you talk a little bit about your work and what you see out there?
Sure. I do have to point out I'm here because on my own as an individual and not on behalf of my employer. I am an operations specialist for the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management here in the city. But this is really my passion. So climate adaptation, I didn't know about when I was in college, or I may have gone that route. I really find there's a lot there to go with. So I think with emergency management and the topic of preparedness, reaching out to folks, everybody, is always a challenge. And that's part of why I've been drawn into this, because this is a continuous sort of thing that we're trying to address. How do we talk to everybody? How do we reach everybody where they are? How do we not teach but learn from them also, and bring this, bring all this together in bringing all of our knowledge together? Not just what can we teach you, but what can we learn together? How can we go forward as a community? And I think that's what drew me to Drew. Was that this isn't about Drew, this is about the community. And this is about empowerment, not fear, which I think is a critical thing. If we're afraid, we walk away. That's too big. What are we going to do about this? The earthquake? You know, I don't know what that looks like. I have not experienced that. Or if I have, you know, there are very few people who have. And so it's about it's about stepping out of the fear and stepping into this empowered space. This is what I can do. This is what I already know. This is what I already have. I just need to apply my own skills to a different situation. And thinking about all those things can bring us to that space. And I think that that's what Drew is doing here. And I think it also, there's an aspect of our daily emergencies. Everybody has these daily things that we're trying to do. And it's so easy to push other things aside. And as we reach some of these communities that are harder to reach or feel more excluded from the general system of things that are set up, those daily emergencies can make us not really be able to think about a bigger emergency that may not happen, because we've got these daily things that are happening all the time. So like when we talk about the houseless folks, I mean, they are living an emergency. How do you help prepare folks for something different when they are trying to get through today? So I think those are some of the questions that we're able to really talk about through Cascadia Stack and reaching out to folks the way that Drew has designed.
This might sound simplistic, but can you give us a list of all the potential emergencies that we might face here? I know that sounds like a Debbie Downer, but can we talk about it a little?
Sure. So some of the things that we talk about, we just went through was some potential flooding in Johnson Creek. So we have these heavy rain events. So flooding.
We had loss of life there. Yeah.
Yes. We have earthquakes. You know, we could have wildfires. I hate to list all these things, you know, because I don't want to create fear in anybody. It's a preparedness thing. You know, and then we have tornadoes occasionally. We had a little tornado in the Northeast a few years ago. Wind events, all those sorts of things. I think with climate change, the things that I'm mostly thinking about are the heat dome sort of events.
Another one with loss of life.
Mm-hmm. Things that we just aren't prepared for, only because we haven't really experienced them yet and we're not thinking about them. And so part of what we can do in these groups and in these conversations that Cascadia Stack wants to have and that we should be having outside of Cascadia Stack as well, what have we not thought about coming to us, these heat domes or wildfire, and think through how we would use what we have now or make plans to prepare for those things and react.
I had to jump in here because my sister lives in a place called Placerville, California, where they had catastrophic fires for the past, I want to say, 3 years perhaps. And this issue of how to think in advance and do it without fear and figure out how to be prepared for that, that is so thorny. And my sister, her partner, their kid, they live in this little area where the wildfires, it's in a little valley, and the wildfires 2 years ago, they were told, you know, have your go bag ready in your car. And they could see the flames coming above the rise into their valley. And the firefighters, we love you firefighters, were able to stop the spread. Mm. But my brother-in-law doesn't want to leave the house anymore. Okay? Real mental health impact. And that's even it's almost beyond fear. And they had to keep their go bags ready for 3 months. And it took a lot for them to talk about taking them out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I also went through the neighborhood emergency training, the NET training.
Awesome.
It's a neighborhood-based, theoretically, neighborhood-based training where people can come. I feel like you volunteer. I think it costs some money, but not a lot of money. And we went through a really deep workshop. We learned things like how to put out a fire, how to leverage heavy materials off of someone with pieces of wood. We learned how to set a broken bone. We learned how to all kinds of things. And it changed. The thing that blew my mind, though, about that, the thing that really blew my mind, going again to the mental health impact, was we had this big, it was a big book that we read through, a big workbook. The very last chapter in there, and this is going to sound crazy. Do I always say it's okay to cry during this show? I do. It's okay to cry. But the very last chapter talked about how when there is a rescue institution that comes and helps people, in the end, over time, the community turns against that institution. It's a deep psychological impact. Think about Hurricane Katrina, where you know, emergency people, whatever, firefighters, whoever it was, came, and National Guard came and helped people out. But in the end, people, because they couldn't help themselves, because where we can't help ourselves and where we don't have the connection with our neighbors and a real neighborhood team and a real plan like that, we can start to feel oppressed by whoever comes. And, you know, one of the examples, the symbol of that was, you know, for people who went through the entire program, we got a hard hat, and we got officially registered by the city, covered by their city's insurance, and we got a backpack full of gear. And one of the gears we got was the key to turn off people's natural gas. And we were specifically warned, if you ever use that, whoever you did that to, they're going to thank you at first, and then they're going to get really angry, because 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they're not going to have any gas, and only the people from the gas company can come and turn that thing back on. So you have to have the strongest possible connections with your neighbors, and you have to be prepared to help yourselves and know the long term. I know that's hard, but this is kind of a hard conversation. But in the next hour, in the next half hour, we're going to talk about the real things that you're weaving together, the real tools to help us really work together. And I do also have to say, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Keeping It Real.
This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. Our guests are founder and director Drew Alcoser and volunteer advisor Amanda Westervelt from Cascadia Stack, a local organization working to build climate resilience in surprising and impactful ways. You blow my mind every time. And briefly, you had mentioned mitigation, like going back to that issue of how can we prepare to adapt? I have to come back again and say, Jordan Fink, Build Soil, they're planting chestnut trees. They're looking at the long game. It's the most fascinating thing. And you can go online to kbu.fm and look up the interviews I've done with him. It's amazing. And you can look for him online, Build Soil. But there's amazing people doing things everywhere we look. What were you going to say, Amanda?
Oh, I wanted to say that the NET training, I'm also a NET, and it is free.
Right,
so
on,
I want
right
to make on. Sure Good. That everybody knows it's some of the best training you can get
for all kinds
yeah,
of things. It doesn't
absolutely.
There doesn't have to be an earthquake. Like
no.
just yeah. Anyway, I just had to say.
Okay.
So let's dig into what you have coming up. Okay, you have a preparedness workshop scheduled for late January in Vancouver in Spanish. What will participants be doing? Talk about that. What can people expect?
Well, I would love it if people would sign up to become either NET volunteers or CERT. CERT is Certified
CRT.
Emergency Response Training,
right,
I believe.
Right.
So Portland has NET, and Beaverton, et cetera, has CERT. CERT is kind of a nationally recognized program, yeah. And so that's kind of the end goal, to sign up people to take this training like you explained. Thank you for explaining that. It's very in-depth. But at our 90-minute workshops, they're pop-up, so they're all over the place, and we will learn just the basics, just kind of learning, just seeing where people at, what they know, what they would like to know, and just explaining. The first one that you mentioned is knowing your neighbors. And the second one would be the communications plan. And that's basically, you want to get a person that lives outside of this area, because the phones will be down, the electricity will be down. And I'm talking about the 9.0 Cascadia megaquake. And when it gets to Portland, it won't be a 9.0, but it will be significant. We'll definitely feel it. So we want to have somebody that's outside of the area that we can get the information to. So if you are here and your family is across a bridge, you want to be able to somehow call the person in Utah or wherever and say, let my, you know, significant other know that I'm okay. And that communication plan, it will be priceless. And then you want to get your documents together, just kind of making a list. And I want to be able to follow up with the folks that attend over 3 months and say, hey, did you take these three basic steps to empower yourself? And that's kind of what I want to do. And that's what we can expect in our situations.
All right. And Cascadia Stack has two programs right now. Was that one of them? Tell us about the two.
Right. So that is our How to Prepare Emergency Preparedness Workshops. The first one, like you mentioned, will be in Spanish language in Vancouver. And we're hoping to do five of those total in 2024. Our second program is the Climate Resilience Circle. And we're hoping to continue that. Our first one was in November. We have a venue for January, big announcement, January. And that'll either take place the third or fourth weekend. And that will be in North Portland. The Climate Resilience Circle, again, those are pop-up salon-style events, 90 minutes, where we give a safe space for people to talk about how the climate crisis is impacting them. And just, you know, embrace that grief, that stress, anxiety. There's tears, there's hugging afterwards, and we all come together as a community. And it feels good. It feels really good knowing that there's other people out there that feel the same way as us.
There was something else I was going to say, that we just went over the two programs. I wanted to ask you, so really you're planting seeds, and that we talked about that. You know, we talked a little earlier about, like, that's the beauty of tabling. And with the NET programs and with a lot of this emergency stuff, it's a handful of people who have a whole bunch of knowledge, actually training knowledge and even tools perhaps. How does the information ripple out to everybody else? I know that's a weird question, but each person who participates in this will be a hub of community. So what's your vision on how to really share the knowledge?
Right. So we do hope to be able to sign up, you know, a handful of people to get the proper training and to become certified so they can get those little gas shutoff keys.
and hard hats. The hard hats are cool.
Yeah. And be able to take it to their community. Have a block party. You know, get a bounce house, get some boozy snow cones, and and talk about this stuff with your neighbors. You know, you may not see them except to wave hi in the driveway or something, but to have those conversations and say, hey, do you guys have any, you know, medication needs or physical disabilities or trauma that we need to know about so that we can make sure and get you the care that you need when an emergency happens?
Right. And it's also, you know, what are your hobbies? Like, what kind of trees do you have in your backyard? Do you have a wine cellar? You know, it's stuff like that. That was the weirdest thing about the net. It was all done by the five firefighters. Mm. And they could be a little bit cynical in a way, like because they were talking about such a broad cross section of the community. And I don't want to go all Democratic National Committee on everyone, but this is exactly what Rachel Maddow was talking about when she said, take the time to build connections with people who maybe don't vote the way you do, or maybe don't share all of your values. And when you're talking about a neighborhood, that can be much more of a cross-section of people. Mm-hmm. There's not like Republican neighborhood. Well, maybe Lake Oswego. I did not say that. I thought it. I did not say it. But can you talk a little bit, and I know this is a weird question, but as you're doing this work, and then after this, I want to talk more about the focus on the Latinx and Latin and indigenous communities, but how it means something to be able to reach out to people that may not vote the way you do or share your values. And some of that actually does have to do with not believing that climate disaster is a real thing. Mm-hmm. But do we have ideas on how to still build common cause with our neighbors? I mean, mm-hmm. That's a trick question, I guess. But I mean, what do you think about that?
Right. That's good. You know, I try to watch the 15-minute snippets of Rachel Maddow on YouTube on Tuesday mornings. And she recently had Liz Cheney on her program. Yeah. Wow. So that's a great example of talking to someone, your neighbors, who you don't necessarily, you know, vote the same with. I just moved to Kalama, Washington. It's very rural. And there's not even a stoplight in the town. But, you know, if there's a parade or giving out candy at Halloween, everybody's out there and we're having a blast. And I think what's important is to find that common ground. And it doesn't have to be climate, but we can talk about the crazy weather and how it's getting worse. So it's not using the word climate change or climate crisis. It's just the crazy weather. Or maybe it's talking about their kids or their grandkids or something they just put in their yard. It's just finding that common thing. And we all care about something. And it's just asking questions and listening.
And I don't actually know any earthquake deniers, but I'm sure they're out. I'm sure we're out there. I don't mean to they anybody. So now I want to step over to this issue of focusing on non-English speaking communities, non-white communities. I mean, Portland is progressive in a lot of ways. We also are historically a Klan state, you know, so there's fissures there. There's cracks that you can't always see. And the thing that strikes me about these issues, like around language, is that if we don't broaden who we're talking to, we're leaving out the best and brightest. Right? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that strikes me about it. But how did you begin that focus on Latinx, Latin communities? How did you begin? Because reaching for workshops in Spanish, that's a quantum leap. I'm putting that out. How did you do that?
Well, personally speaking, I really see a lot of strength in my Latinx community. I want to see us thrive and help rebuild after the Cascadia quake or whatever emergency, because we are strong people, all Portlanders are. And when we're called to action, we show up. And I really find that our Spanish-speaking neighbors and friends, they want to be a part of Portland too. And, you know, I'm here for that. I'm signing up for that every day.
All right. Can we... I want to step a little bit more into that and talk about the language for people that are listening right now. People there, I know that there's brilliant people and they're thinking, I want to do a thing and I want it to be inclusive. Talk a little bit about inclusive language on this and how we can best use and understand it, if you can.
Right. So With the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, we should hold our government accountable for equitable service delivery and decision-making, planning, policy-making, and resource allocation. Absolutely. And we at Cascadia Stack hold language justice as a high priority. I don't speak Spanish, but I've become acquainted with Yvonne Ribeiro, who has a Tuesday afternoon show on KBOO right here.
Yvonne.
Yes, and she's given me a lot of information. She has informed me that 25% of America is Latinx, and we're fierce, and we are hard workers, and we love people. So language is important. I want to support our elders. A lot of times it's the elders in the household that are not proficient English speakers and need a little help. And so I want to support that. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. And because the other thing is, we're talking in a lot of ways, we're talking about skills and we're talking about community and we're talking about getting along. And I know that in some of the spaces that I've shared with people, we look at language as the ultimate barrier, and yet we all have so much to share. And I'll say it again, some of the best and brightest people, we need all of us, all the minds and all the hands. If you just tuned in, this is KBOO Community Radio. You're listening to Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests are founder and director Drew Alcoser and volunteer advisor Amanda Westervelt from Cascadia Stack. Okay, now I'm going to ask something really specific. What's the Mad Libs marble game? What is that? What is that?
That's a fill-in-the-blank thing. So, I don't know, if any Gen Xers are out there, shout out to Mad Libs. You're going on a road trip and the parents stick you in the back seat with a Mad Libs book. So it's like, tells funny stories and you fill in the blank with adjectives, verbs, etc. So I'd go out to do tabling events. I did two. And the climate crisis makes me feel blank. So I had six bulls and each of the bulls had a different feeling. So there was anxiety, guilt, detached, hardened, hopeful, and reserved. And reserved would be like, well, I'm not really going to say there's pluses and minuses. I'm overwhelmed. I can't, you know, anything. Or hardened. You know, hardened is, you know, you're watching Fox News. I don't know. And detached, like, I am addicted to TikTok, or, you know, and a lot of people turn to substances too. So, you know, it was really interesting seeing people's decision making when they're putting the marble in the bowl. And so that, you know, it was a way tabling to Mad Libs marbles, and it opened up conversations. And that's exactly what we do at Cascadia Stack, is have those conversations.
I want to stop there and dig into that a little bit. What are people talking about? What are they saying? I know when there is an emergency, a lot of people are going to be looking at substances. And then there's the people who need to have certain kind of medications to get by. That's kind of a substance too. What are people telling you? What are they worried about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're worried about their kids and the future generations. They're worried about the devastation. People who are environmentalists, they're very touched and very sad to see the land that they love being so impacted. And people are just in grief.
I know some people who were driving through a forest. Where was it? Was it in Alaska? Just last month, where a big wildfire had gone through, and they were crying about it. And I know that there's regeneration after a fire, and yet that's not the whole story either. There's a sense that we are part of the environment. Can we also burn down? I'm just putting that out. Mm-hmm. And so as you are having your monthly events, and in a minute I want to ask you about the preparedness workshops you're planning to hold in 2024, but I want to dig down into this a little bit even more. You're engaging people on different levels than a net training. I mean, the net training, you learn so much in those. I can't believe it. Like, I actually had to put out a fire myself. I thought I was going to have a cow, but I did it, you know, actually going through the motions of doing these things was way different than watching a YouTube video and putting that out. But as you're having these events and you're playing a game where you're asking people about their emotions, talk a little bit about the tools you're using at each of these events, right? You're teaching people things. You're getting their buy-in. You're also hearing them, I suspect. Can you talk a little bit about what are the other tools that you're using at these incredible events you're doing?
Right. The Climate Resilience Circle, our professional facilitator specializing in climate resilience, she has four steps. And the first one isn't so important, is just to acknowledge that when we're, you know, using substances or TikToking, whatever, we're denying those feelings, and to embrace that, and so that we can get to a space to move on from it and empower ourselves and continue doing the work of advocacy or, you know, activism, and just showing up for people in our lives. And that 90 minutes that we spend together, it's just so validating, because we live in our own little worlds and our own little hula hoops so much, and we're all trying to be politically correct, and we don't want to traumatize or have those conversations where it, you know, like Thanksgiving dinner where you're with Uncle Joe and, you know, you don't want to be
combative.
It was Aunt Joanne.
I mean, for real. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, you don't want to be combative to people, and we don't have a lot of time to go into depth with things, so we hold those emotions in, and it just builds and builds, and we're either gonna, you know, eat Twinkies, or, you know, we're gonna act out or have aggressions and things like that. And those resilience circles are to bring people together to heal.
And going back to what I just said about my Aunt Joanne, I love you. One of the other things that happens, though, is we'll be in a social situation and we'll start talking about something, and all of a sudden what we disagree about becomes the biggest thing in the room. No, the world's coming to an end and we need to be prepared. No, that's not a real thing. I mean, to figure out a way to step back, and instead of just, I have to be heard right now, you have to admit that I'm right. That's hard. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the emotional piece, right? Mm-hmm. Because my brother-in-law he used to be a Republican voter, and he's not anymore. And it hurts me to see someone who's a strong person who is afraid to leave his house because even though there's no fire, he's afraid something bad could happen and he could lose everything. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. That's really what it is. Mm-hmm. So using different tools, talking about people. How many of the preparedness workshops do you plan to hold in 2024? And who are the participants you want to make sure show up for those?
Mm-hmm. We're planning five of them for 2024. January 27th, our first one in Vancouver. And we'll have the next one March, I think it's the 10th. And that will also be in Vancouver. And we're going to try to get some Indigenous folks to come in. But this one will be English speaking, and the rest of them will be English. And then we'll probably have the final three in the Portland area.
But long into short, though, you want everyone to come.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is there a place for kids in there?
Not sure about that. I
maybe it depends on the age.
Not sure about the appropriateness of the topic. Mm-hmm. People may not feel as comfortable being real, especially in the climate resilience circle, if there's someone a little, you know, less than a teenager there.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So as you have these events, and maybe this is something that you've already answered, we're getting close to the end of our hour, and I just want to make sure that everyone has the basic information. So for someone who shows up or signs up for one of those preparedness workshops or the monthly circles that you have, what can people expect? Let's start with the preparedness workshop. You're signing up for that. What can they expect?
So we're going to have time for people to talk about what they know and what they'd like to know. It's going to be more of a give and take. It's not just someone giving a talk. So it's more hands-on. We may have an activity as how to, I'd really like to get into rain catchment systems because of water. Like, oh my gosh, they're saying we should prepare for 2 weeks, a gallon per day for each person in your household, plus your pets. Oh my gosh. How do you store your water, and how long does it last? So, you know, just different things, and different facilitators may have different information, but I really want to focus on the basics and put that point out to having that communication plan. So setting up a plan for yourself to make those actions.
For people who just tuned in, Drew, can you share one more time an overview of what you do and your goals for it?
Sure. So we are building climate resilience and emergency preparedness skills, building resilience now so that the next generation is prepared. And we want to effectively promote climate resilience hubs in every neighborhood. And I know Portland is on the fast track. It's already happening. But that's what we're supporting in the whole Cascadia bioregion. And we really hope that more and more people can become aware and learn about it. And we want to make preparedness a hobby. We want to make it, I don't know, cool, but a hobby that we work on every weekend.
And when we say a climate resilience hub, that's training. And is it also resources?
Yes, absolutely.
What's in there?
So that would be having resilience so that post-disaster we're able to thrive. And so that could be, you know, rain jackets, it could be blankets, solar blankets, first aid, water, cache of food, etc.
And a map of places where people can get stuff too. I feel like they're like you already talked about the map. Sometimes that's an important thing. I remember when there were big floods in Tillamook years ago. When I did the NET training, they talked about the example of Tillamook. There were huge floods, and the Fred Meyer store there stayed open because they had a generator. And it was a central place where they just allowed people to come in to dry off and be warm. So it's not even necessarily just people. It's not necessarily just government. It can be businesses too. Mm-hmm. And if you have a business and you know what you're doing, you can be part of that hub as well. And so, Drew, also, for anyone thinking of building a community project as you have done here, are there any, on any important issue, what advice do you have? I know there's people listening. I know there are.
Right. And I mentioned this earlier. I got involved with Citizens Climate Lobby and the Portland chapter. I got involved in the movement. I made connections. I got a service commitment where I was there. I joined some teams and did some tabling, and I started making connections. Social media has been big, where I've been able to, you know, just stay in touch, go to different community-based organizations events, read the newsletters, and start making friends. And then you start to see the needs. What's not covered, and how can I support? Because Portland has a ton of nonprofit organizations and community-based ones giving a lot of direct services. And so you don't want to reinvent the wheel, definitely. But you want to support that. And what are they not covering? What are their barriers? And find a way to support that.
Right. So you built on existing work.
Exactly.
And you looked, you found your niche, your thing that no one was doing. Yeah. I love that.
Climate adaptation is, I wouldn't say it's new, but it's becoming more mainstream and talked about.
Interesting. Because this is still, I don't want to use that trope, the cutting edge, but we're still learning so much, even though some of this knowledge is ancient, it's odd, it's new, it's old.
Yeah, and at COP28, which is happening, it's a 12-day climate event won't get into that. But for the first time, climate health and climate anxiety has been addressed. And I think it's 125 countries made an agreement to achieve these climate health goals.
And one more time, tips about reaching out to diverse communities and weaving our efforts together. I know that's a big question, but I just want to make sure that people keep that volume next to all the other volumes of knowledge. What's the best way for people to reach out to have a diverse community in their community project?
I would think those different events. I go to powwows. I'm invited. I asked, do you have to be a registered tribal member to table at your powwow? And they say, well, this one you do, but sometimes you don't, you know, so it's just asking questions.
Getting involved.
It's getting out of that introvert self. You could go home and snuggy blanket later. Just have a moment to get to know some people.
Okay, Drew, how can our listeners
support what you're doing?
Well, I am looking for a volunteer or two to do these follow-up emergency preparedness workshop phone calls. That would either be a text or a phone call, and this would be, you know, a couple hours a month. I'm also looking for financial support. I am a fiscally sponsored by Cascadia Now nonprofit organization. I can accept donations. You could go to CascadiaStack.com and look for the donate tab. You can become a monthly sustaining giver. $5, $10, $15 a month would help us plan our pop-up workshops and pay our facilitators. Or you can make a meaningful one-time gift. That would be awesome. And please follow us on our social media. Cascadia Stack is on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
All right. I just want to thank you both for being on the air with us today.
Thank you so much for having us. And thanks, Amanda. And big thanks to the Cascadia Stack family and friends and facilitators. And thanks, Lisa.
Sure. Thanks to Drew and Amanda. They have a preparedness workshop scheduled for January 27th in Vancouver. Find out more about what they do online at CascadiaStack.com. You're listening to Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving on KBOO Portland. You can make a contribution to support programming like this at kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making all of this possible. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kbu.fm. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds